Welcome to A Cult of Personality at acultofpersonality.net. Thank you for listening.
This is A Cult of Personality, podcast episode number 118, featuring an interview with Paul Weston about his book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky. Thank you for listening. Support for A Cult of Personality podcast comes from the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section, as well as all those generous listeners from all over the world who click the donate button on the occultofpersonality.net website to sponsor this episode. Thanks again to Steve in the UK, Michal in Slovakia, Neil, Adela, and Shadow Lit Productions. I also want to take a moment to mention the upcoming 2012 Esoteric Book Conference that will take place in Seattle, Washington, on September 15th and 16th. Tickets are available now through their website at esotericbookconference.com. I'm honored to be the moderator for the discussion panel entitled Eastern Thought in the Western Occult World, featuring Craig Williams, Salvatore Zambito, and Gordon Jurjevic. I look forward to seeing you there. Now, in podcast episode number 118, Paul Weston returns to the show. He previously appeared in A Cult of Personality podcast episode number 106. Paul is a visionary, author, and lecturer who resides in Glastonbury, England. You can find him online at paulwestonglastonbury.com. In this interview, Paul and I continue our conversation about his wonderful book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus. This book is a fantastic exposition on Crowley, magic, Thelema, and the greater context of history that surrounds its inception and development. Weston also shows remarkable courage in tackling head-on a myriad of related subject matter, including Nazi occultism, ufology, and psychedelic drugs. We spend considerable time here talking about Liber Al Vel Legis, the Book of the Law, and the cipher code it contains. Paul Weston, I want to welcome you back to A Cult of Personality podcast. It's a pleasure to speak with you once again.
And it's great to be back again, Greg. I've greatly enjoyed our last little chat.
As did I, very much so. And the purpose of our interview this evening is to try to cover some of the remaining ground in your book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus, that we didn't really get to last time because it's just so packed with information and diversity of subject matter that it requires another recording.
Well, that's what I like to hear. I certainly put a lot of time and effort into creating it in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. It's wonderful. Again, I want to urge listeners, if they haven't already heard our previous interview, that that would be a good place to start, probably. However, let's assume that people listening are familiar with the book and have heard the previous interview, and I'd like to start, you know, with that in mind, so we don't have to cover a lot of the background material that we did in the last recording, and can get right into some of the really juicy material here that is controversial. But I have to tell you, Paul, the more people I speak to and the deeper I go into these subjects of esotericism in general, the closer I come to this subject, which I certainly didn't expect to find here, and that's ufology.
Yeah. I think the whole business of Crowley and his alleged ET contact with this entity, Lamb, which is something that you'll find splattered all over the internet, is a pretty good place to start, because obviously Crowley is the most legendary, the most notorious of all occultists. And to postulate that he might perhaps be some kind of ET contact towards the beginning of the previous century seems pretty wild and wacky. And because it's such a widespread story, it's worth kind of going in there in detail. It's certainly the place that I start from in my book, because I'm thinking to myself, if this concept of the Aeon of Horus has any validity to give us a handle on the mystery of the 20th century, being as the UFO phenomenon is one of the most bizarre and outlandish distinctive aspects of the broader story of the 20th century, then surely there should be a few little signature signs, if you like, of the Aeon of Horus in there, if that idea does have validity. So the fact that Crowley's been put forward in this way was my point of departure. Now, it's an interesting thing to unpack, because it's one of these typical infuriating topics that you simply can't nail down. It all begins during the period when Crowley was in the States, during the period of the First World War and the immediate aftermath of that, when he was going through a phase working as an artist, actually producing paintings and drawings and so forth. And in 1919 in New York, he displayed an unusual pencil drawing of this kind of big egg-shaped face. And he also published it at the beginning of a detailed annotated version that he produced of H.P. Blavatsky's The Voice of the Silence, not an esoterically loaded work like Her Isis Unveiled or The Secret Doctrine, but quite a short, pithy, mystical, and almost Zen-like piece. And he had basically just written a few sentences in which he'd referred to the way, and that Lam is a Tibetan term for the way or the path, and follow that path. And that's that painting, pretty much that drawing, I should say, pretty much disappears off the radar from that point on. It's kind of mysterious that it's there at the beginning of that piece, but it's not something that Crowley scholars particularly picked over. But in 1972, the most notorious of all Crowley's followers, Kenneth Grant, a man who's, you know, been praised and also lambasted as someone that has either really hit the essence of what Crowley was all about or massively distorted it, published the first in his sequence of occult works, The Magical Revival, and he reproduced this drawing and referred to it as LAM, an extraterrestrial intelligence that Crowley was in contact with. Now, Crowley had actually given this original artwork to Grant when Grant had been his secretary in Crowley's last years, when Grant was only about 20 years old. And there's no real indication that we can honestly say that Crowley has ever referred to this, whatever it's depicted in this drawing, as Lamb itself, given it the name Lamb. But from that point on, the name has stuck. And it's become Crowley's most famous piece of artwork, because if nothing else, since the 1980s, for example, when the image of the greys from Whitley Strieber's Communion, for example, really became heavily imbued into the collective consciousness, there was an obvious point of similarity between the two. And Grant had suggested that this image was very potent for opening up altered states of consciousness, a state of what in one of his books I think he called extraterrestrial gnosis. And one of his leading associates, Michael Staley, has helped to develop what you could call a cult of Lamb, in which people meditate on the image. They imagine going inside this giant weird domed head, seeing it out through its eyes into unknown zones, altered states of consciousness. Now, a few years back in Britain, the magazine 40 and Times did a little piece on this and tried to say that basically maybe there was no such intention at all to create an image of what we'd call an alien, that in fact it dates from Crowley's interest in Taoism, in Lao Tzu, that there was a lot of stuff he was writing at the time that he created this drawing. It's just a picture of a Chinese Taoist that Crowley had believed he'd been a past life with Lao Tzu and so on. It's just a bad drawing of a Chinaman. Now, this is just absolutely typical in as much as it kind of makes a lot of sense, but it's how much mileage can you get from this thing? How powerful and potent are these ideas? After the Second World War, we've got the legendary Babylon working with rocket scientists Jack Parsons, Marjorie Cameron and L. Ron Hubbard. And, you know, here's a guy who really has opened up the portals and thinned the veils through his experiments with rockets. And he's reciting Crowley's Hymn to Pan when he's launching these things up into the stratosphere. And Grant has kind of said in his books that he feels that Parsons opened a window and that something flew in. And this is another thing that has just gone all over the internet and is almost kind of like a truism, just like it's now just accepted that Lamb's an ET, that Crowley was a contactee. So Parsons somehow opened the window, because the Babylon working was 1946. So this is in the immediate run-in to when the ufological era began in earnest in 1947. And it is very interesting that at the end of the Babylon working in March 1946, Marjorie Cameron had actually seen some, what we'll now call, unidentified flying object of some kind in the vicinity of the legendary mansion where the working had primarily occurred. And she had thought of it as something that was prophesied, you know, spoken of in some way in Crowley's Book of the Law. But a year or more later, when the UFO phenomena really kicked in, she looked back on it and felt that possibly, you know, there was something going on there. And what seems fascinating right off the word go is that although most people tended to think in the late 40s, early 50s of UFOs being nuts and bolts manifestations, actual machines with living beings of some kind in them from other worlds, there was also a whole bunch of people who were clearly mystical, magical in their orientation, often mediumistic in their general personality types, who were tuning into this thing, this mystery, were coming up with all kinds of unusual ideas and claiming some sort of contact with the whatever the force behind it was. And sometimes coming up with things that have got an obvious kind of overlap with what we'd call the magical tradition. I mean, Jung, you know, 10 years later wrote his famous book on flying saucers, and he was clear that although some of these things will show up on radars and will demonstrate something that indicates there is a physical reality there, there's also clearly a consciousness aspect. They're intimately connected with the people that are actually seeing them and experiencing them, especially the contactees, people that are not just seeing lights in the sky, but are experiencing some kind of direct connection with whatever is behind it. And a real good early case study is a guy called Meade Lane, who had a background in all manner of Western mystery tradition, esotericism, ideas that had come from the likes of Golden Dawn tradition through Dion Fortune and also, I believe, Rudolf Steiner, these kind of things. And he's got a psychic on board called Mark Probert, who was channeling some alleged 500,000-year-old Tibetan master, you know, this kind of malarkey. And as early as 1946, there'd been some strange sighting of some weird black tube over San Diego. And he'd asked this psychic, you know, what's going on here? He had sensed that there was a mystery, that something was coming. And this guy had kind of said, yeah, you know, there are these beings that are trying to break through and make contact with your world. And he came to believe, he talked about ether ships, you know, in 1950, I think it was, he wrote a little pamphlet on the ethership mystery and its solution. The idea that what people were seeing was something that was at a faster rate of vibration than our sort of material world, that was kind of slowing down to our rate of visibility, that was blinking in and out of reality, that was multidimensional, And that was in some sense a thought form of the beings inside it. And the whole cosmology behind it was not a million miles away from the Kabbalah in certain respects, in as much as where these beings come from is not somewhere entirely different. It's actually right here, right now, but we're just not able to perceive it because of the limitations of our consciousness. So that's fascinating right from the word go. And perhaps for me, the oddest, the most bizarre character in the in these early, early days of ufology is a guy called William Dudley Pelly, who's perhaps notorious, if he's known at all these days, in the States, for having been, they called him the Star Spangled Fascist. You know, he's a guy who stood for president in the 30s, didn't exactly do very well. I think he only got a couple of thousand votes. But he was a real Hitler freak. He's a major figure, if you like, in if you trace some of these far-right Aryan Nation survivalist groups, the kind of people that became quite well-known in the 80s in America, trace some of the people back, you actually find William Dudley Pelly. And the thing about Pelly, he's very mediumistic. He's very psychic. He had an out-of-the-body experience in the late 1920s, came to believe it overwhelmingly in the truth of the existence physically of Jesus and the whole New Testament story, but came at it from a rabidly anti-Semitic angle, and also believed through contact with Jehovah's Witness ideas and so on in pyramidology that the history of the world was kind of somehow laid out by the dimensions of the Great Pyramid. And he believed that when Hitler came to power in 1933, this was one of these great pyramid destiny moments. And he supported Hitler, ended up getting slung in jail by Roosevelt during the Second World War for just not shutting up when he should have done. And when they let him out, he started having these mystical experiences in relation to whatever was going on in the sky, you know, and believing that he was in contact with these entities. And he got a whole cosmology of war in heaven, I think, between Sirius and Orion. And it was very, again, full of this bizarre anti-Semitism whereby, you know, the bad guys in the war in heaven are played out in the world. And this is strangely familiar to some of the current climate. International bankers, international Zionism, the Jews are, this is a kind of theosophical warp out, really, that the Jews are the result of some kind of evil alien race trying to make its way into controlling the world, a whole bunch of stuff like that. And Pelly is also saying that these things are essentially ether ships, that they're something that are working at another rate of vibration, that they blink in and out of reality, that their thought forms can controlled by the entities that were within them, and that we're now in a kind of last time situation, and they're all part of a broader manifestation of some Book of Revelation scenario. So all of that is kind of the window in, and then you've got, you know, all the classic cases of the 50s. Now, I could just rab it on and on, but if you want to chuck in some, you know, actual distinct questions into all this.
Yeah, absolutely. There's just so much to choose from here. It's hard to know where to go. But Kenneth Grant.
Yeah.
He's certainly an intriguing character.
Sure.
Personally, I find his work to be compelling, but it does have a sensationalistic feel to it that I think is undeniable. And I think that that characteristic really touches most of the evidence put forward by a number of these, the people involved in the subject. And you mentioned Pelly, Mead Lane, George Adamski. I mean, none of these people really inspire confidence in that their integrity is unquestionable. That
this is one of the fundamental issues, I think, when you get into this. People like John Keel later talked about the Cosmic Joker. And, you know, there's this idea of the archetype of the trickster, that there is certain knowledge, certain gnosis, if you like, which is transmitted in such a way that it really tests you in as much as it doesn't conform to any of the structures that you want, you know, gnosis right. to conform to. And it seems that ufology has got this built-in absurdity right from the word go. I mean, so many, as you say, Adamski, you know, Pelly himself, a number of the other contactees, they themselves do not inspire confidence in terms of their own personal biographies. The actual material that they come up with is often, by all conventional standards, barking mad. And you'll also find, you know, a full spectrum, and this was outlined by people like John Keel, of high strangeness, you know, complete absolute absurdity. I think there's, you know, the amount of entities that have been seen coming out of, you know, alleged landed spacecraft and so on, they range so widely, and sometimes, you know, they are entirely absurd. You know, Bigfoot wearing a check shirt walks out of a spaceship, this kind of stuff. You know, dwarves, strange stuff relating to the proximity of rabbits, you know, with UFO sightings, full range of monsters and all the rest of it. You are in a kind of dreamlike zone. You are already in a space where your rationality is being undermined. Now, my feeling has been this trickster factor that is there, and that people who are adherents to the nuts and bolts or hypothesis don't like, I think, to really acknowledge the full spectrum of high strangeness in ufology, because they feel it in some way undermines their credibility. My feeling is this stuff has been there right from day one, and you simply can't do justice to the subject if you ignore it, and you can't do justice to the bizarre nature of so many of the characters that have been involved in it. And the fact that you just can't pin it down does mean that when people try and research the nuts and bolts side of it, there seems to be a point that they're just never going to get beyond. I mean, how many years now have people been talking about disclosure? You know, I can remember when the Close Encounters movie was being made back in the mid-70s, that people say, oh, yes, Spielberg's been, you know, given all this insider information, and there's going to be full disclosure over Roswell and all the rest of it, and, you know, when the movie comes out. This stuff just keeps coming round year after year, decade after decade. Nothing really changes. You know, however many alleged sightings there are, however much brouhaha there is, certain things remain essentially the same. And that intangible thing is what you somehow try and get to grips with. And it's just, what is, if there is an intelligence behind all of this, what is it doing and why is it manifesting now? You know, that's possibly the real big question.
Yeah. I mean, it seems clear based on what you're saying, what you've written, and along with many of the people that you've mentioned here, that this phenomenon, maybe one could argue that UFOs or these, what we think of as alien entities, are maybe taking this form, we could say, in order that 21st century human beings, or 20th century human beings, as the case may be, could contextualize the experience.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this has been batted around on in the ufology realm somewhat, and certainly, you know, with regard to other types of paranormal phenomenon. So I just wonder if you could talk just about that a little bit.
Well, okay, I think there are two writers and two books that I consider to be, you know, essential primers for a particular way of looking at ufology, which is the one that I adopt and the one that I've always found the most fruitful. Firstly, there's Jacques Vallée and his book, Passport to Magonia, and then there's John Keel with Operation Trojan Horse. Now, what both of these guys are essentially saying in common is that there is one phenomenon that has been with us, that has been intimately connected with our life as humans for the complete time that we have been on this planet, and that phenomenon is as much a part of the life of this planet as we are, whatever its ultimate point of origin is. that it shapeshifts, that it takes on the forms of all manner of angels and demons and ghosts and vampires and paranormal phenomena and mysteries of the landscape all the way through history, all the way through all different cultures, and that it is interconnected with our own state of consciousness. It changes in relation to how we change. And the examples, for example, that Ballet gives, stories of people being abducted by the fairy folk. You know, they come upon some mound in a field that's alight with from within. They go in there and they meet with these little dudes, perhaps, or unusual dudes. Time and space get completely warped out. They may have strange experiences inside there. They might even have a sexual encounter with one of these beings. And then they come out and they're completely spun around and maybe years have gone away. It's strangely similar to some of the classic abduction cases, to the extent that you feel that there is a common denominator somewhere. And again, with Keel and his studies, you know, he looked into all angles of the paranormal, and the classic case ultimately is the Mothman case, where you've just got a complete spectrum of stuff all happening simultaneously. You've got, you know, a scary monster, you've got ufology, you've got a whole load of strange poltergeist activity and communications from, you know, alleged entities in other realms. You can't separate one from the other, and also you can't separate the percipient from this. You know, Keel always played it down, but I'm absolutely convinced that, you know, he himself was a major factor in certain things that came together around him, because he'd had a remarkable life himself as a paranormal investigator, as a traveller around the world. I mean, he'd spent his 25th birthday with goddamn Yazidi, you know, back in the 1950s. He'd, you know, stalked the Yeti on the slopes of the Himalayas. He was pretty well configured to be the man at the centre of the Mothman scenario. And when people perhaps belittle his telling of the tale, they perhaps don't realise the way in which particular types of figures that are almost shaman or magician in their own right, whether they think that way or not, can somehow be the focus of these things. And that now obviously takes us into the mysterious realm of the contactees and occultists through the ages, particularly people like Crowley. What exactly is it that they're stirring up, and where is it all coming from?
Indeed. And I'm curious, because I've considered these questions for countless hours. Obviously you have as well. And I don't know that we're ever necessarily going to reach conclusions that can be grasped intellectually. And one of the aspects of this, which I find more interesting, is the way people react to this information, especially people who consider themselves experts in ufology or occultism. What are some of the reactions that you get to this type of material, promoting the ideas that occultism and ufology are, at the very least, touching upon some type of phenomenon that seems to be amorphous and can change shape? You talked about the trickster aspect. I'm really curious about the acceptance of these type of things.
I think the acceptance of these kind of things, part of the mysterious flavour of the times, is some people have speculated that perhaps the ufological mythos is a carrier wave of a whole kind of package of greater ideas that have loosened people's heads up, expanded their states of consciousness, that can't be separated from everything that happened in the 60s, for example. You know, there was a definite, certainly in Britain, what you could call psychedelic ufology. You know, one of the things, books that inspired me more than any other was Robert Anton Wilson's Cosmic Trigger, because it was very, very squarely facing this whole issue of the absurdity of these things, the way there's a spectrum of material that starts off in what you might call the paranormal, the magical, the mystical, and can't be separated from ufology, and that cosmic joker factor is all helping to shake our minds loose a little bit and open us up to a whole lot of other possibilities. I think the people that, as I mentioned earlier on, who perhaps resist it the most are the hardcore nuts and bolts ufologists, the people who are really, really clear that we're talking about actual physical machines from other worlds. And perhaps people, you know, don't like the, who think that that will in some way be undermined or made to look foolish in some way by acknowledging the high strangeness. But the high strangeness, you know, I would just say the high strangeness, clearly we must need it at this period of time. There is something about it that is enabling people to think in categories they weren't otherwise able to do so. You know, back in England, for example, in the 60s, there had been a certain amount of speculation that UFOs followed old trackways that we tend to call ley lines, alignments between ancient sites and all the rest of it. And people ended up going out because ufology was the flavour of the time. It was in all the newspapers. There were all kind of things in the media. People ended up going back out to these ancient sites and so on, hoping to see UFOs. They didn't necessarily see what they were looking for, but they ended up getting really interested in the ancient ways, what was going on with these ancient cultures, and a whole kind of subject was revitalised, brought to life. And certainly right here, right now, in a place like Glastonbury, we're living on the legacy of that. And somewhere along the line, the ufology is still there a little bit, but it seemed to sort of dissolve into the background. And it was like, okay, job done. And perhaps a similar sort of thing in the 60s with psychedelia, that it almost seems that all the hardcore acid heads at some point came to a point where they believed that they were in contact with something or another, some distinct entity, some force that was perhaps extraterrestrial. You got it with John C. Lilly. You got it with Timothy Leary. I think in the electric Kool-Aid acid test, there's a point where Tom Wolfe describes some of the merry pranksters having experiences where they felt they were tuning into stuff that was coming from outer space. It seemed to be part of an inner process that was going on at the same time as the space race, as, you know, an enormous explosion of our sense of knowledge of where we are in the universe. And it's all, you know, propelling us in the direction of, you know, the big mythos now is the 2012 Gnosis. There's an awful lot of ET expectation around there that I think in conventional terms, if you're thinking, you know, like something out of a bit of 1950s sci-fi, fleets of flying saucers coming and sorting us all out, I don't think it's going to work like that. But somehow or another, it's propelling people into thinking and acting in certain ways they wouldn't otherwise have done. And then they'll suddenly find that perhaps that mythos has receded, but that their lives have changed and something's different. And that's the mysterious way in which certain kinds of ideas weave their magic down through the history of culture, you know, occult ideas, magical ideas, spiritual ideas. And in this case, you know, ideas around the enormous ufological mythos.
Yeah, it's just really fascinating to me. I can't stress this enough. Now, you pointed out the trickster aspect of this.
Yeah.
We've talked about the fact that the contactees tend to be, let's just call them fringe characters for the sake of brevity. And that's not to downplay the achievements of someone like Crowley or even Kenneth Grant, but the fact of the matter is, in terms of mainstream culture, these people are fringe.
Yeah.
One of the things which keeps them on the fringe, aside from the whole UFO connection to begin with, is the fact that tangential to this subject of ufology and occultism, we seem to continually run into Nazism, fascism, and anti-Semitism. Can you just say a few words about these connections?
Yeah, it is. It's a disturbing and a strange one. I've pointed it out with William Dudley Pelley. Okay, you know, he's there right at the start now. He's a really interesting mover and shaker in the early ufological scene. He is quite an influence behind a guy called George Hunt Williamson. Now, he's a really fascinating character in his own right. He's somebody that at quite a young age met up with Pelly, met up with Adamski. He was actually with Adamski on the famous occasion when he went out into the Mojave Desert and then stopped the car and went further away and supposedly had his ET contacts. He soon starts, through his own natural mediumistic capacity, trying to contact the Space Brothers using a Ouija board, coming up with a whole bunch of really interesting things about ancient astronauts. This is way before Eric von Däniken and Raymond Drake, for example, talking about various people that have reincarnated throughout history and played out dramas relating to ET on Earth, if you like. And he has this war in heaven cosmology. And yeah, part of that war in heaven cosmology is that the good guys, you know, the white master race, if you like, although he's not quite as blunt as that, come from Sirius. And there's these sort of the bad guys who in certain respects are almost like Nazi caricatures of Jews are hanging out. I think it was in Orion. And that there's an influence on the international banking system and through these people and Zionism and all the rest of it. From the point of view of 1950s America, on the one hand, you know, the Nazis have been defeated and their crimes have been revealed. But it's surprising that you don't see as much about the Holocaust in general culture in the first few decades afterwards. It's something that we're very, very familiar with now, and it's something that's there through a tremendous amount of literature and films and documentaries. But it's something that wasn't looked at quite as full on back in the 50s, especially also at a time when you've got this massive anti-communist paranoia. I think some of this is kind of a manifestation of that. But even then, all the way through, right up into the present day, there are a number of people, channelers, if you like, of alleged extraterrestrial sources, ascended masters and all the rest of it, who could be critiqued as coming up with a kind of spiritual fascism. And certainly, there's a whole mythos around Nazi ufology, the idea that they had not just attempted to make some experimental craft that was saucer-shaped, and maybe this was part of the Operation Paperclip package of material that went to the States. Maybe some of the early UFO science were actually the US government trying to fly some of these Nazi craft. The extreme forms of this say that they made contact with ETs, you know, during the war or even earlier than that. There's a whole thing going on there that goes back to the gods of Babylon. This is it's weirdly evocative. It's very powerful stuff. And it just, I think, keeps us in this war in heaven duality, which is perhaps one of the big problems that we've got in the culture at the moment, that we just have to somehow think that we have an adversary who we can project a whole bunch of metaphysical stuff on, and somehow that we have got to triumph in a warlike manner over them. You know, whether what Jung would say about it in relation to the integration of the shadow and so forth is another thing altogether. But it's something that people really do get obsessed with, and they pick up the ball and run with it, and they go into some very, very dangerous places with it. You know, the legacy of Pelly is a strange one. And something that people should be aware of, you know. And I think some of these other characters, if they'd had the same opportunities as him, who knows where they would have got to with it.
There's certainly so much to explore here. One of the things I just want to touch on and highlight before we try to tie this back into occultism and Crowley and the Aeon of Horus, I just want some opinion on this background material that we encounter in esotericism about the star Sirius, the fact that some sort of guiding intelligence or energy comes from certain stars, and the notion that for some reason it seems like in modern times we like to literalize things to a great extent. And I'm curious if you think that this these references to Sirius or other star systems, are they literal references in the tradition, or are we talking about some more allegory that has perhaps been grown into something altogether different?
Well, first of all, I'd say, you know, I'm very much a devotee of the Sirius mystery as it becomes expounded by the likes of Robert Anton Wilson in Cosmic Trigger. But I'm also aware of the fact that you've got to keep a kind of critical intelligence about it. Looking back to ancient civilizations, they would have a kind of connection with star lore that's difficult to recover from a point of view of our mindsets in terms of how they would see the seasons and, you know, what to do when. All of this was tied in with stars, the mythology of these cultures, the deities, are all a reflection of what they experienced turning around in the heavens. And a star like Sirius, which at one point in the Egyptian calendar was linked to the inundation of the Nile, it's going to get linked up with, for example, the goddess Isis and so on. Although I very much believe that some of these cultures, Egypt in particular, had a tremendous amount of knowledge that we're only now beginning to give them credit for, in terms of their knowledge of precession of the equinoxes and, you know, the kind of geometrical gnosis that is embedded in the Great Pyramid. It's another state of consciousness altogether. But the thing that I think people miss out on is if you're out in the desert, for example, and you've got the night sky above you, the vividity of it is absolutely startling, and also the nearness of it. These days, because of, you know, the knowledge of astrophysics of the last century or so, we have got a sense of just how far away these things are, and it's mind-shattering. You know, they are vastly, vastly, vastly far away. If you've got the thing just a little way above you in the sky, or so it seems, and if you're a technologist, if you like, of the inner realms, whether it's through the use of hallucinogens or just, you know, natural abilities that you can experience what we'll call a shamanic or a magical flight to the stars, you may well gather, you know, you may well have a, what you might call now a download. You may well seem to travel to this place, which you're not going to be intimidated by the mental data we've now got of the sense of if you went there physically, it would take you, you know, you'd have to go into deep freeze, and it would probably take you a few human lifetimes to even get anywhere near the place at the maximum speed we can currently manage. I think there's that kind of whole thing is a potent factor in the psychology of the ancients. And because of that, I think that they had more of a sense, a more readiness sense of the closeness and the connectedness of what they were looking at and the feelings that they got from all these constellations. I'm still willing to believe that it's possible that they can actually in some way make a connection with something, some mysterious, intangible something. You know, I'd recommend to anyone who hasn't seen it yet, for example, my friend Andrew Collins' book, Cygnus Mystery. He makes some very, very interesting and valid speculations about the influence of Cygnus on ancient cultures and the fact that, you know, all manner of intangible particles and cosmic rays from Cygnus have hit the Earth and have been, you know, somehow picked up on by Stone Age shaman down in their caves, who've then depicted Cygnus on the walls of their caves. I think that it is possible to get a genuine download from the stars, but whether that actually means that there are weird guys in space suits standing in some strange sci-fi 1950s chamber on the other side of the veil, pressing a load of buttons and loads of flashing lights everywhere, somehow making that happen is another thing altogether. I think that's something that it's all part of unthinking our categories that the trickster force is leading us to, that somehow maybe enable us to get a handle on what is really going on in these situations.
Now, I'd like to shift our focus slightly to talk about the Book of the Law,
yeah,
the Cipher, And I'm trying to grasp here at the best sort of segue to do that. And I'm wondering if maybe we talked about Lamb.
Yeah.
Just in the interest of clarification, because even myself, I'm not exactly clear on this. Would you consider the entity referred to as IWAS to fall into this sort of category that we're talking about in terms of some sort of ultra-terrestrial intelligence, or is this more of maybe a more traditional ascended master type of...
Well, I think they can be both. You know, I mean, John Keel came up with this term ultra-terrestrial, mm-hmm. and within that sort of broad spectrum, you can include LAM and IWAS. You know, some of these beings take on forms, you know, the angels and demons, the gods and goddesses of ancient cultures, perhaps. Others wear masks that are more in keeping with, you know, the futuristic psychology of the moment. It's very puzzling, you know, the idea of the shape-shifting phenomenon. On the one hand, you've got these very weird sci-fi type entities making an appearance, but that doesn't mean that the old forms, for example, visions of the Virgin Mary, or, you know, visions of ancient Egyptian deities, or Jesus himself, or you know, the various bodhisattvas of the Buddhist tradition, they still appear in their standard garb, maybe because they're so powerfully, you know, full of emotional content in the collective mind. But that's something that is a difficult one to figure out. You just have to sort of look at it and say, that appears to be the case. You know, where can you get to by working with these ideas? But yeah, I think IWAS and LAM can be broadly similar, but obviously LAM is very controversial. There's no doubt in the presence of the idea of IWAS in Crowley's work and in the Book of the Law. It's absolutely central to it, whereas LAM, it's controversial to suggest that there even is such a thing as LAM in the first place.
Right, yeah, that's an important distinction, I think, that doesn't always get made. I'm curious, how much of the background of the Book of the Law do you want to cover?
I think what's you know, one of the points that I really wanted to make relating to the cipher code, you know, I certainly want to go into that a little bit, because yeah. It leads us even further into the mysteries I've already been discussing and the issues, particularly the trickster issue that seems to come up here. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a nutshell, in the Book of the Law, there is a sense that there is unfinished business. That it's actually said in the text that he needs to basically find the order and value of the English alphabet. In other words, a kind of English alphabet Kabbalah. And there's also, we've got the original sort of handwritten typescript of Crowley's initial dictation of the Book of the Law. And in the third chapter, there's an enigmatic little passage where there's kind of a line at an angle across the page. And it seems like he's drawn a grid across it, and there's, you know, there's the sense of it being a code. And he tried to work this one out during his lifetime and never really figured it. One of his followers, Frater Akkad, Charles Stanfield Jones, managed to sort of get a handle on it. But it wasn't until the 1970s that a workable English Kabbalah seemed to be figured out, you know. And this was once we've got into the computer age, if you like, this kind of thing comes in. And Alan Greenfield wrote a fascinating book called Secret Cipher, the Euphonauts. You know, he worked with this English Kabbalah and started to realize that, at least supposedly, and we'll say supposedly, some of the numerical codes relating to names of UFO entities down through the famous, you know, contact period of the 50s and 60s seem to all be adding up to similar sort of numbers to the likes of the entities of Thelemic occultism. For example, in this particular system, IWAS adds up to 38, and then you do a kind of reduction on that, 3 plus 8 equals 11. The famous Ashtar of Ashtar Command, you know, is a 47, 4 plus 7 equals 11. There's a bunch of these things that all add up to 11. there are various other things. So he basically felt that what was being revealed was a functional unity between ufology and occultism. There's another book he wrote called The Secret Rituals of the Men in Black, which is an absolute hoot because it creates a version of Crowley's most famous occult ritual, Liber Samech, which is a ritual to contact your holy guardian angel. And all these kind of ancient barbarous names of evocation, as they're called, that date from a Greco-Roman fragment of a magical papyrus that the Golden Dawn used, that Crowley used. He's kind of substituted a whole bunch of names of ufological contact entities that all add up to the right kind of numbers to contact, you know, the headless beings from Sirius. Now, you know, I know people who have got very strong reactions against all this stuff and they really don't like it. I think it's a hoot. I really do like it. But what I think's intriguing about it is it reminds me of a lot of the issues and controversies around the so-called Bible codes. You know, a while ago, there were some books that came out that basically suggested there were numerical codes in the Bible that prophesied absolutely everything that's ever happened, and therefore prove that the Bible had divine authorship. You know, in other words, it's come from an intelligence beyond the human. And then one of the critics of this work discovered that all of the various things, you know, prophecies of assassinations and great events in history that you could work out through this Bible code, you could get exactly the same result using Herman Melville's Moby Dick. And that is kind of absolutely hilarious. And it's also, in a way, kind of terrifying as well. I mean, on the one hand, it deflates the sense of the uniqueness of the Bible code, but you're left with a bigger issue of how the hell is it that the universe hangs together in such a way that you can ever get a result like that out of any text whatsoever? You know, how can you possibly get a result like that out of Herman Melville's Moby Dick? What are the laws of mathematics and their isomorphism to language and the way that it's used in a book like that? You can ever find such a thing in there. You're left with an even bigger issue. Now, I don't know. You know, for all I know, you could find all of the names of the entities of ufology and occultism using a similar code approach using a Jane Austen novel. You know, I don't know if anyone's ever done it. Ultimately, you know, it is that sense of the trickster and the cosmic joker. What I think you're left with, you know, through, say, Alan Greenfield's work and through this pursuit of a potential link between ufology and occultism and the full spectrum of the paranormal, is the mood you're left with and the way that you are somehow coaxed into thinking and feeling in certain ways. And as a result of that, you know, life, the world, and how your mind works changes. Everything seems differently. And as a result of that, your life will change. Things will be different. And you feel like you're perhaps being set up for something at a future date. You know, what that is and whether the carpet is pulled from under your feet or not at the correct moment is another thing altogether. Because as John Keel found out, these entities, these guys, whatever they are, you know, they're prone to lying. You know, they're prone to misleading you. They'll give you a whole bunch of results of tell you this is going to happen, that's going to happen. It does. Then they'll tell you that there's going to be a mass landing of spaceships at a particular point. You get all your crew together. Of course it doesn't happen. Or the world's going to end at a particular point. Of course it doesn't happen. And then, you know, you're left pondering what the hell has gone on. Now, Keel came to feel that the whole thing was ultimately, you know, in conventional terms, demonic, that it was evil, that these things were, you know, voices of deception, and that they were leading us astray. And he, you know, retreated into a kind of paranoia there. And, you know, there is this impasse. There is this sense of some of these creatures, the men in black, for example, serve as a kind of guardian of the threshold, and a very broad theme that's there in the magical literature around Crowley and Jack Parsons, the crossing of the abyss, that perhaps is a collective abyss that, you know, humanity needs to somehow cross each, you know, in each individual's distinct way. And that some of these, you know, problems of these, whatever this mystery is all about, are dramatizations of these things writ large for us.
Do you mean to suggest I may be inferring too much from your words, but it sounds to me like you're implying that whoever or whatever is behind this is somehow testing and trying those who come in contact. And one of the things I'm wondering is if you could argue that perhaps some of the information, the fascism, the anti-Semitism, some of the claims about visitation or disclosure, I guess is the popular term now, that these things are almost like a test for the receiver. Let's give this person this outrageous information that most people will dismiss without second thought and convince the contactee that this is real and they must spread this message. Are they going to pass the test and call us on it and say, forget it, I'm not doing it, this is a bunch of BS? Or are they going to take the ball and run with it and thereby somehow discredit themselves, essentially?
Well, there is this sense, and I get it very strongly, that there's, on one hand, what you might call an initiative test, that a whole bunch of people are being probed to see, you know, what the level of responses are, and that there are also themes that you would recognise from the archetype of initiation, whether that's an initiation into a magical society or whether it's more the personal process that people like Jung might have called individuation, the things that you have to go through to navigate, what you have to integrate, what you have to take on board as you work your way through to, you know, ever greater integration and a higher level of coherence and understanding. These things somehow present us with a mythic drama that feels like it's in keeping with that.
Yeah, it certainly does. I'd like to spend just a few minutes talking about the cipher contained in the Book of the Law. You already spoke about it in terms of the background. In my own study of this, the more I look at it, the more impressed I become at the elegance of the fact that this seems to function and that it clearly seems to me, not being a mathematician or anything like that, that the intelligence behind the cipher in the Book of the Law is simply not anything close to human intelligence. What is your thoughts about that?
Certainly Crowley himself, even with what, you know, he initially came to, the prevalence of, for example, the number 93 in some of the Kabbalistic attributions of some of these, the main words in the text. Now, before we even get to the English Kabbalah and all the rest of it, he always believed that this was proof that it had come from a non-human intelligence. And it is very daunting. You can't quite imagine how can the human brain come up with this thing of its own accord, especially if perhaps it scarcely realizes it's doing it. Now, one of the contentious areas that I think is interesting to bring in here, especially in the light of the ufological topic, is the whole crop circle thing. Now, an awful lot of these designs have been shown to contain all manner of mathematical and geometrical marvels from which one can extrapolate ginormous mystical cosmologies and all sorts of stuff about I-dimensional, this, that and the others in 2012 and so on and so forth. And there's certainly a fervent belief amongst many people that these things have not been created by humans for that very reason, that the amount of knowledge that is somehow in them simply cannot have come from a normal source. And yet, you know, knowing people like Andrew Collins, who's been very close to the crop circle mystery for decades now, as I do, and having been paying attention to it myself, I'm not in any doubt at all about the fact, and this might be, you know, controversial to some people, that the vast majority of these things are created by human beings. But if you use the word hoaxster, you know, and things like that, if you make out that these people are simply fraudulent, if you like, and are passing off something pretending to be something is not the case, and working some bad joke. I don't think that's the case at all. A lot of the people that are doing these things are quite mystical, are having extremely strange experiences in the midst of doing all of this, and are somehow, you know, becoming the vehicle for something else, some that ultimately is perhaps a higher intelligence. And they don't necessarily know that all this stuff is in there when they put them down in the first place. And yet it is in there, and it's infinitely mysterious. And I think a similar kind of thing probably broadly pertains to some of these mystical texts that have got this kind of coding in there. Quite how it works, I don't think we'll understand that in our lifetime, and I don't think we're even supposed to. You know, I think it's having the emotional apprehension that such a higher level of consciousness even exists, and that we're potentially the vehicle for it, is enough to be going on with. You know, that immediately puts you way outside of consensus reality, and the whole way the world works or doesn't work, as the case may be, and all the things that are wrong with it that need to be put right. You know, you will buy into that less and less if you're functioning from that kind of belief system, and maybe that's part of what it's trying to do, you know, to bring in an enormously higher level perspective. But again, you've got this, you know, there's something, you know, Greenfield talks about it, that you still get stuck in that duality of the war in heaven, that there's something that wants people to be free, and there's something that wants to keep them like they are. And at the moment, we've got all this stuff about the reptilians, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think to get stuck in it is a bit of a cul-de-sac, and it's better to just focus on what potentially frees you up from all these things and takes you beyond them.
That's an interesting point. Focusing on the things that confine us isn't always unproductive, I guess, is the word I'm looking for.
Well, you certainly need to be aware, if you like, if, you know, Gurdjieff would have said something along the lines of, you've got to actually be aware that you're in prison in the first place if you're going to try and escape.
Right, right.
But then you kind of look for the people that have already escaped or have escaped before you, and what, you know, how did they do it? Where are they? How did they do it? Rather than looking at all the intricacies of the jail and the jailers and how they function and how their world is.
Touché, yeah. I'm curious, in your research, your years of study in this material, your own opinion, does it matter if this cipher is intended to do anything beyond validate the text? I mean, is that the main important point here that we should take away from English Kabbalah, or is it so multi-layered that it would be foolish to try to reduce it?
Well, I think what Greenfield did with Secret Rituals of the Men in Black, where he creates this workable ritual in which he's you know, updated one of the classic texts of Western occultism of the last 100 years to fit all this stuff in, and suggested, you know, maybe it's a potent thing. I mean, I took it with me to Egypt in 2009 when I was still writing a book, and was able to go and see the Stele of Revealing in Cairo Museum and recite the Book of the Law in front of it. My intention was I was going to go out on the Giza Plateau and actually do this thing at a place called Jebel Ghibli, which is sort of hill out on the edge of the plateau. I was going to completely go for it, but I got ill, things intervened, it didn't work out that way. But my sense was to go for it. My sense was, ultimately, I guess, you will only know if you try and take these things on board. I mean, on the one hand, it's incredible to perhaps validate a text as apparently the product of a non-human intelligence. But then there simply has to be another level of the game. You know, whatever that non-human intelligence is, isn't just asking us to potentially say, well, okay, you're there, fair enough, we'll leave it at that. You know, I think there's always going to be what happens next. If this has been active in the life of the world from day one, which if it almost inevitably has, if it exists, it almost must have been, then why is it intensifying now? Why are we coming to this level of understanding now? You know, what is it about the nature of the times? And surely, what are we supposed to do about it? You know, I mean, the word of, you know, the ethic of Thelema and Crowley's work is do what thou wilt should be the whole of the year, whole of the law, rather than contemplate what might be the case should be the whole of the law. There's a definite call to action there, that this is a time for action.
No doubt about that. And that seems like a perfect segue into asking you about your thoughts on the current state of the world. Things have changed a bit since we last spoke, and I'm curious if you have any comment about what's going on.
Well, okay. I am very intrigued and have been for some considerable time by what I'd call the 2012 mythos. Yeah, it's not just a disaster scenario like we had in the Hollywood movie, and it's not just about the Mayan calendar, although the Mayan calendar has flagged it very strongly. It does seem to be about, and for people that want to check this one out, I would heavily, heavily recommend John Major Jenkins' book, Galactic Alignment. A lot of people know him from Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. In Galactic Alignment, he looks right across the world's cultures, you know, Egypt, India, you know, the medieval Gothic cathedral culture, all this kind of thing, to say that the essential stuff that we've got playing out on an astronomical level seems to have been known about, broadly speaking, by, you know, the mystics of, and specialists of cultures down through the ages. I'm really, really into this. And I'm into, I also quite appreciative of José Arguelles, you know, that I think the guy was an incredible visionary. I think he was flawed. I think there's some things about what he said and how he does stuff that I don't endorse. But back in 1987, we had this massive event that he created, the Harmonic Convergence. You know, people called it the Psychic Woodstock. I think they also called it the greatest pseudo event in history. You know, we can now say that his understanding of the Mayan calendar seems to have been a bit skewed. But he had this prophetic sense that, you know, we were accelerating through a 25-year period that would culminate in 2012. And all the old forms would fall and dissolve. And the initial thing was that there was a 5-year period after Harmonic Convergence that took us up to 1992, where the world would kind of get a big shake-up. And during that period of time, sure enough, you know, Berlin Wall came down, Germany was reunited, Soviet Union dissolved, Eastern Europe changed completely, and we had the first Gulf War. And now, as we're in the run into 2012, in the last couple of years, an awful lot of similar turbulence is starting to happen again. Now, I think people confuse the planes, to use Dion Fortune's terminology. They have these perceptions of spiritual events, ascended masters, you know, Ashtar Command, light ships, angels, ETs, you know, the full works, they're channeling all this stuff. Yeah, this is maybe happening on another level of the Kabbalah, should we say, somewhere. It doesn't follow that it's actually going to play out in the 3D world that we live in on that level. You know, as we come down into Malkuth, we're going to have all this stuff playing out, like the Arab Spring and Gaddafi and a whole bunch of stuff. You know, the turbulence, disasters in Japan, the issues around Iran, all this kind of thing. And it fits in with the other great visionary of 2012, which is Terence McKenna. You know, Terence McKenna came up with this exponential acceleration theory that I first came across in Robert Anton Wilson's Cosmic Trigger. That things were just going to accelerate faster and faster and faster, and that stuff that might have taken decades would be happening in a matter of years, and then ultimately it would all just fine-tune itself into the final chunk of 2012, and we would be getting stuff as significant as the discovery of fire, the discovery of the wheel, the exploding of the atom bombs at Hiroshima, all happening within about 5 minutes of each other. Now, I'm not entirely sure, you know, that I endorse that, but there clearly does seem to be exponential acceleration. And it's one of the things that I do actually write about as a meta-perspective in my Crowley book, that the breaking down of old forms and acceleration seems to be something that has really begun in earnest round about the beginning of the 20th century and has just picked up and never let go ever since. And the new psychology, if you like, of fluidity and multiple perspectives that's absolutely essential for us, you know, that is potentially there, being shown to us by what the new physics of 100 years ago showed us about time and space, the kind of things, the disciplines that people like Crowley engaged in and that people like Gurdjieff also showed us, they're what we need to navigate, you know, this extraordinary intensification. Because if we hold on to the old forms, you know, we're the ones that are going to dissolve with them.
So, Paul, I want to wrap things up for this section, and I just want to give you an opportunity if you had anything you just want to mention or include, and I'm hoping people will tune into the second section where you're going to be talking about the Grail legend and Arthurian England.
Yeah, I mean, we'll call it the 12th century Grail epoch, and our particular period of time gives us a very interesting angle on those whole issues of Bath and the Grail. But where I'll kind of round off now, you know, this Kenneth Grant, whatever we can say about him, we know that he's a mystic. You know, some of his earliest interests were in Indian religion, in Advaita Vedanta. And I guess in that, there's no dividing line between the inner and the outer. So you could say that all of this ufological gnosis relating to Lamb and so on, it is inevitably part of the inner world and is part of psychology and spirituality. And there is just this sense of an expansion of our sense of identity and possibilities through this. And I really like the idea that Philip K. Dick had, that there's bits of us are all functioning in different times simultaneously. And that the idea, perhaps, you know, you have the idea of past lives, that's kind of conditioned by a linear progression of time. You know, it's not necessarily the sense that you had a life in the past. You know, essentially that life is happening right now. All of our multiple lives are simultaneous. And I'll give some credit, very few people do, but I'll give some credit to L. Ron Hubbard, because he gave us the idea of the option of other lives in other galaxies, you know, in what you might call the space opera cosmology of Scientology, the idea that maybe, you know, some of our alleged past lives might have been on other planets, in other galaxies, in other situations. Well, with the logic of Philip K. Dick, you know, those lives in other galaxies may well be simultaneous. We may well be vastly multifaceted beings that are existing, you know, all over the universe simultaneously. And this whole ufological caper is just other parts of ourselves somehow trying to establish complete communication so that all the universes, you know, function ultimately as a unity. You know, it's a wild, wild idea, but we go back, you know, right to the beginning with Mead Lane again, and his idea that where these things come from is not somewhere else from where we are right now. It's just that we don't have the necessarily expanded perceptions to be aware of it. And part of the nature of the game is to somehow cultivate those perceptions. And then, you know, that is the kind of thing that will really make a difference to the future of the world.
Well, I appreciate all the work that you've done in this area, Paul, because you're certainly one of the few who is willing to wade into this subject matter and bring forth all these gems. And I thank you again for joining us this evening to talk about it. And I can only recommend that people read your book, Aleister Crowley and the Aeon of Horus, because
concur with that, yeah.
As much as we'd like to get into it and have a discussion about it, it's hard to really do justice to your book because it is very compelling. It's fascinating. There's so much material there. And again, you know, I said this the last time, but it really impressed me the way that you wove all of these elements together in this narrative, and your commentary and opinion about how it all fits together is simply remarkable. So I hope that people will check it out if they haven't already.
Okay, excellent. Well, thanks, Greg. Once again, a pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely.
For the Occult of Personality membership section, Paul presents his insights into the times and places surrounding the legends of the Holy Grail and King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, expounded in his wonderful book, Mysterium Arturius.
His research and unique perspective provide a background that makes these tales even more alive. Join us